Daily loads for the Laguna de Santa Rosa. Okay.
Here's my MC.
They just left, but this is an information item. I want to keep going because we got a huge, long day tomorrow. And
shall we begin, Mr. Corbett?
Yes, you may begin.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairman Corbett, members of the board. My name is David Kuzmar. I'm an engineer on your staff in the TMDL and Basin Planning Unit, and I'm here to introduce item 5 on today's agenda. As you may know, I serve as the project lead for the development and implementation of the TMDLs for the Laguna de Santa Rosa. And our last update to the board on the Laguna TMDLs was November of last year. And during that discussion, we described our work in two parallel tracks. One, items of work related to technical TMDL development, and two, items related to what we were referring to as early implementation actions. The subject of this item today is on that former category, technical development. Specifically, what you will hear during this item is a report on what we have learned to date about how sediment and nutrients contribute to the Laguna's various water quality problems. For the presentation of this item, we are lucky to have with us today, to my left, Dr. John Butcher from Tetra Tech, a leading provider of scientific and environmental consulting services. Dr. Butcher is a registered professional hydrologist and environmental engineer with over 25 years of experience in watershed planning, environmental modeling, and TMDL development. Not only has Dr. Butcher contributed to the development of numerous TMDLs and watershed models across the U.S., he also has special knowledge of the Laguna de Santa Rosa, because he helped contribute to the well-known Altered Laguna Conceptual Model Report in 2007. It's probably worth mentioning that Dr. Butcher and his team come to us by virtue of a lucky stroke, essentially, an existing contract between Tetra Tech and the US EPA. And they have provided us assistance through two separate phases of work in two key areas. First, Tetra Tech has developed an updated sediment budget for the Laguna de Santa Rosa. The final product is something we are very excited to have, and it is soon to be released. Secondly, Tetra Tech has undertaken a review of all available nutrient data for the Laguna and staff's preliminary analyses and modeling efforts to date. That effort is still ongoing. Dr. Butcher will now describe both of these efforts in further detail, and I will return at the end of his presentation to wrap things up and to entertain any questions you may have. So with that, John, please take it away.
Dr. Jonathan Butcher, Tetra Tech. Thank you for having me here, Chairman, members of the board. As Dave said, my role here is really to take some of the extensive work that's been done on the Laguna in the past, reconcile and integrate those efforts with emphasis on reconcile, because there were some conflicts that needed to be resolved, and provide analyses to unify first the sediment budget and then the sediment and nutrient budgets together. Today, we can present the final results of the sediment budget analysis and discuss the ongoing work on the nutrient analysis. I think this will, when completed, give you a strong basis for moving forward to getting to implementation in the Laguna. So I want to start with a little bit of background here. Most of you know this pretty well, but the Laguna de Santa Rosa is a very important resource. It's the largest freshwater wetlands complex on the Northern California coast and is a designated as a wetland of international importance. It has provides habitat to threatened and endangered species. It's an important migratory bird resource. It also provides a lot of flood storage volume for floods on the Russian River in the Laguna Backwater. And, of course, aesthetic and recreational benefits to citizens of Sonoma County. So take a short look here at the Laguna at an earlier stage in history. This is an 1845 map of the Rancho de San Miguel, and it's a little disorienting because, wrong button. That's even more disorienting. Because north is down here. We have the Santa Rosa Plain. This is Santa Rosa Creek. This is Mark West Creek. Oh, sorry. And this is the Russian River down here. I need smaller fingers. Okay. So I'll try to stop doing that. We see in the middle of this picture a backwater established between Mark West Creek up past Santa Rosa Creek, showing a relatively large body of open water. That's the Laguna as it used to exist. The picture also gives you a good early perspective of the general topography of this area. There's the Santa Rosa Plain declining between the Mayacamas Mountains, going down to the Gold Ridge where it backs up. So you have kind of a bathtub down here where all the material flowing this way collects before it goes over ridgeline and into the Russian River. Should also note in this map that Mark West Creek was subsequently, about the turn of the last century, altered to come backwards about 2 miles and dump directly into the body of the Laguna instead of more directly to the Russian River. This has resulted in a large loss of historical water and wetlands. On the left is a map of the approximate extent of open water and dark blue wetlands and lighter blue about the 1850s. This is based on old maps, hydric soils, various other items like that. So there's an extensive body of open water, a lot of wetlands, both of riparian wetlands and wetlands associated with the open water in the middle. Now, on that same map on the right, we've imposed a USGS map of conditions in the 2000s. The background is still the 1850s, but that same section, the light green, is now area that's mostly been converted to vineyards and agricultural lands, but does flood on approximately annual basis. The blue part in the middle is remaining permanent wetland, so still very important permanent wetland, but only a small fraction of what used to be there. The stuff that has been going on with the Laguna has resulted in biostimulatory conditions that are most obviously seen through the infestations of Ludwigia, the water primrose that we see in a lot of these channels now. And those arise from a combination of shallowing due to sediment influx, the availability of lots of nutrients in the system from both historic and current reasons, and then the opportunity of this invasive plant, which has resulted in a lot of overgrowth and choking of the system. We'll get back to that connection between sediment and nutrients and about stimulatory conditions in a moment here. So as I said, there's been a lot of past work done on this system. There was first a detailed study sponsored by the Corps that Philip Williams and Associates released in 2004 that it contained a detailed effort at a sediment budget for the region. Following that, there is a 2007 report, the Altered Laguna, which Dave mentioned, which tried to take that basis forward to give a detailed conceptual model of how things are working in the system. Following that, in 2006, and for the next several years, U.S. Geological Survey measured sediment concentrations, calculated deposition rates in the Laguna, calculated loads in the system. Unfortunately, they never released a formal report on that work. There isn't a peer-reviewed article in Wetlands that describes all of it, and we worked with the USGS staff who had been in the process of doing that work to get all the details of what was going on there. So this is from the Altered Laguna report, the 2007 report, a conceptual model of how things have changed in the system. Prior to settlement, we had erosion occurring in the upper watershed. A lot of that is transported down across the alluvial fan on the Santa Rosa Plain. A lot of that is basically going out in distributary channels that over time wandered across the plain and deposited most of the sediment on the surface of the Santa Rosa Plain. The Laguna de Santa Rosa down below trapped what the remaining sediment that came through. After a history of agricultural and then other types of development in the watershed, we've changed the way things work here. We still have erosion in the upper watershed, and that's been enhanced somewhat by land use change. We have big changes on the alluvial fan, which is where the city of Santa Rosa sits now, for instance. The channels that used to wander across the plain had also the effect of flooding things, and so they've been converted to floodways by and large, so they're straightened and connected directly to the laguna. As a result, they don't deposit much of their load on the plain anymore, and indeed, in a lot of the cases, we're now eroding the former alluvial fans that are on the Santa Rosa Plain and delivering it to the laguna. Finally, the laguna itself, because of these ongoing effects, has a smaller volume to put that sediment in. So we have kind of an accelerating process of loss of volume in the laguna. So what we want to do in this work here is establish a sediment budget for the laguna. And the reason for that is we need to understand where things are coming from, where things are going, and to be able to design any effective implementation to address the situation in the laguna. We can think of this as balancing a checkbook, the incomes and outlays of the system. And there's a little history here that we need to go into in some detail to understand what's going on here. The consensus of the PWA, the Phil Williams Associates report, and the Sloop report in 2007 was that the empirical method of the Pacific Southwest Interagency Committee, otherwise known as SIAC, for estimating, is an empirical method for estimating sediment loads from southwestern rivers. There was a consensus that represented the best estimate of delivered loads in the system among the available options that they'd studied. Those SIAC load estimates were said to be supported by multiple lines of evidence, including most prominently an analysis of load estimates from turbidity monitoring in the system the PWA conducted and from rates of measured infill of Matanzas Reservoir. But there was a drawback in that this is an empirical method that doesn't really identify where sediment sources are coming from. And then there's a bigger problem. When the USGS did their study to estimate loads in the system, the loads that they calculated from suspended sediment concentration monitoring and flows did not match up, and from deposition of the laguna did not match up very well with this SIAC consensus. For instance, in Santa Rosa Creek, the SIAC method estimated an annual load of about 120,000 tons per year. The USGS estimates are under 10,000 tons a year. Deposition in the laguna, the PWA report based on some early cross-section studies and a balance based on the SIAC inputs estimated about 103,000 tons per year. USGS measurements, about 61,000 tons a year. So this is the point that has kept us for a few years, I think, from moving forward, is that we did these studies and they didn't pull everything together. So we know at least one of these estimates must be wrong somehow. So what we started off doing is reanalyzed both of these types of studies, the SIAC empirical analyses and the USGS load estimates, using a variety of different methods, different load estimation techniques, different implementations of SIAC in GIS environment. You just see on the right there, this is some SIAC estimates using a BOR method that's designed for GIS applications, and shows the darker colors are relatively higher load sources, but it doesn't reconcile the order of magnitude between them. So I need to go through this in a little bit of detail. First, the SIAC average sediment yield for Santa Rosa Creek was noted as matching the infill rate of Matanzas Reservoir pretty well. But that's the average sediment yield for Santa Rosa Creek, including the entire Santa Rosa Plain that drains through Santa Rosa Creek. Matanzas Reservoir is in more erosive uplands and should have a you know, noticeably higher erosion rate than the average across the watershed. But more importantly, this attempt to corroborate it by comparing loads estimated from turbidity had some questionable assumptions. Let me look at it more closely. So what PWA did, and I don't want to blame this on them because this is what the turbidimeter manufacturer recommended them to do, but was to first establish a relationship between suspended sediment and turbidity, use continuous flow and turbidity to estimate a sediment loading rating curve, which is you see on the right here, so a measurement of loading rate versus discharge, and then apply that rating curve to the longer-term flow record to estimate the sediment loads in the system. The problems, there are two types of problems that arose here. First, their rating curve regression didn't go through zero, so it says there's non-zero sediment load with zero flow, because during a lot of the summer flows are near zero, this is actually not trivial. But the other issue is even bigger. The calibration method that the manufacturer recommended is as follows. Take sediment from the bed at the monitoring location at one of these USGS gauge locations, add that weighed amount of that sediment to a fixed volume of water, and this was actually done in somebody's kitchen, it turns out, but mix it up with a paint mixer, and then record turbidity for 6 or 8 points, for 6 to 8 different amounts of sediment addition to get that calibration curve. And it turns out there are not any true split samples for turbidity and in-stream suspended sediment to validate this relationship. So what does this do? Turbidity is a measure of light scattering, and it's mostly due to finer clay particles in terms of predominance by weight. The problem arises really because bed sediment in these streams is not the same as suspended sediment most of the time. Bed sediment is mostly the coarser fraction and dominated by sand. Suspended sediment is often dominated by fine particles that don't settle out until you get to a real slow-moving reach like the Laguna. So between these issues, the bench calibration approach and the regression line not going through zero basically ensures that the estimate they're going to get from this method was likely to be an overestimate. So how do we solve this problem, short of going back and doing several years of study to correlate turbidity and suspended sediment concentration? Well, it turns out there was a lot of work in this done basically next door for the Sonoma Creek TMDL. You see down here on the left-hand side, this is a correlation between turbidity and nephelometric turbidity units and measured suspended sediment concentration with a pretty strong relationship here. And the geology is fairly similar on that side of the line. It's an adjacent watershed. And so we tried applying this relationship to the turbidity data that PWA had used in Santa Rosa Creek. And lo and behold, the estimate from their turbidity correlation, about 97,000 tons, drops down with this relationship to the range of 8,000 tons, very close and within the confidence limits of the USGS monitoring estimate of 9,400 tons per year. Further, we then were able to obtain the results of the Sonoma County Water Agency's MS4 monitoring, which also occurs at Fulton and Santa Rosa Creek a little bit upstream. If we adjust that for the distance from the gauge, it comes out right in the same ballpark to suggest that you should be around 8,000 or 9,000 tons per year when you get to the Willow Side gauge. So we think we solved the problem between these two estimates and suggested that the SIAC estimates in this system are an overestimate. And that's really not surprising, I think, because the SIAC method was designed for basically uncontrolled southwestern river systems in general, and because many of them have more severe conditions in terms of slopes and landsliding and so on than the watersheds of the Laguna, it's not surprising we get a higher estimate. So with that in mind, we could then try to assemble a sediment budget. We want to do that by constraining the delivered loads in the system to be consistent with the reanalyzed loads at 5 gauges distributed on Santa Rosa Creek, Marquess Creek, within the Laguna main stem, and apply a weight of evidence approach to balance all the sources and sinks. So on the income side, we have upland erosion, a group that's contains soil creep, gullies, colluvial bank erosion, and results of slides. Too many words to fit in the arrow there, so I didn't put them all in. Loads associated with the road system, and loads associated with channel incision and degradation. On the output side, well, we have flow through to the Russian River, and we have channel maintenance activities performed by the Sonoma County Water Agency, which turn out to be surprisingly important in this balance. And the balance between them, the amount we accumulate, what comes in and doesn't go out, is the deposition into the laguna itself. So to further constrain this, we needed to take one of these pieces and get an estimate of its order of magnitude so we don't have too many free variables here. We did this by looking at the upland erosion component. This is the rainfall-induced erosion on the uplands using the revised universal soil loss equation or Russell method. It's a pretty trusted method for estimating soil loss, not sediment delivery, but soil loss from the land surface. And the problem with using this method in the past has always been, well, we got to make up a sediment delivery ratio, and that was not a well-poised problem most of the time. But there are new methods to address that problem now. This is based on the connectivity index that Borselli and a bunch of other Italian and Swiss researchers have been working on and applying around the world over recent years. And it's a method that's incorporated into the INVEST simulation model for the Natural Capital Project that Stanford Nature Conservancy and others have been promoting. So the Russell method itself, most of you are probably familiar with universal soil loss equation type of estimates here. We start with combining land use, which is a map on the left here, where the dark greens are forests, light greens are pasture and grasslands, the pinks are urban land, and the purples are crop and vineyard. Combine that with topography, the slope of the system, which you see on the right. Combine that with rainfall energy. There's a strong gradient in, this is in units of erosivity here, so ability of rainfall to detach soil, strong gradient from the highest rates in the northern part to the lowest rates in the southern part of the watershed. The native erodibility of the soils from the soil surveys. The cover that protects land surface from erosion, for which we now have from the Sonoma veg map very detailed LIDAR information. Combine all that together, and we get a picture of Russell soil loss. This is ranging from the dark, from basically the light yellows are near zero soil delivery to the laguna. Maximum points here, a few points going as high as 3 tons per acre per year and a little more in the darkest brown, but most of the watershed has relatively low rates of delivery. You may also notice, if you remember, that the coloring pattern looks pretty much like the SIAC method. So I think the SIAC method is telling us useful things spatially about where critical source areas are, but overestimating the delivery. So the connectivity method, I'm not going to show any equations here, but we're fortunate again to have this very detailed LIDAR at a 1 meter resolution from Sonoma Veg Map. What you're seeing here is a LIDAR picture, no other information on roads, vegetative cover, or anything like that. And you see the detail that emerges from this here with all these little streamlines that represent ephemeral drainage ways across the landscape. And the things that look like roads on here are, in this particular part of the area here, are actually alleys within a vineyard. The lightest colors represent the highest probability of delivery downstream, and the darkest colors are areas that are have less probability of delivery. So basically, the closer you are to a stream that has significant power during the wet period of the year, or a drainage ditch along a road, which is designed to effectively move water through it, the higher probability you have of delivering sediment. When you're in the darker areas, most of the sediment that's loose sediment that's created is redeposited in the soil matrix. So see some of the results of that here. On the left is the sediment delivery ratio that's actually calculated by this method. I should mention that this was developed much more extensively by Olga Vigiak in Australia and some country that has some similar characteristics around here, similar Mediterranean climate, similar wine production, and that type of stuff, and worked out pretty well there. See the actual delivery ratios at the highest parts, which are along some of the steeper streams. If you're eroding sediment right there, you may have a delivery ratio as high as, you know, up around 50%. But for the bulk of the watershed, as you get into the light grays and blues, you're going well below 1% of the loosened soils delivered. What that gives you on the right, finally, is a sediment delivery map for the upland fraction. This one is separated into colors by land use, with the high-intensity colors within that land use having a greater than 2 ton per acre per year delivered, 0.2, excuse me, and the lighter color having a, you know, less delivery. So once again, we can see some things that point out to particular source areas that may be of concern. Parts of the developed area on the north side of Santa Rosa, when you're getting into some of the steeper territory there, and more erodible soils, not surprisingly, seem to have greater risk than other areas, at least in this method. So there are other sediment sources here as well, and we have some uncertainty there. There's no detailed study of road erosion within the Laguna watershed. So we're relying on the rates established in the Sonoma Creek TMDL source analysis. Same with the processes of soil, dry soil creep, slides, and resulting colluvial bank erosion. Should note that these are important, but in the Laguna watershed, this is a relatively low slide risk area, so these are not, you know, like the slide risk you see further up the north coast. And channel erosion and gully formation. We have qualitative documentation of that from PWA, but a lot of the stream reaches are not accessible because they're on private property. Most of that seems to occur in incision into old alluvial fans. We also have to talk about sediment sinks. USGS estimated, the best estimate, about 61,000 tons per year. Output to the Russian River, there's a gauge downstream of the Laguna at Marquette's Creek near Mirabel. That's about 5,000 tons per year. And we also assume that in Matanzas Creek Reservoir, Il Sanjo, and places like that, the majority of the sediment that comes in is trapped. I mentioned the Sonoma County Water Agency stream maintenance. We have records for the past 7 years. It turns out they removed, on average, over 19,000 tons per year from, this is excluding the clean out of Matanzas Creek Reservoir Inlet, which adds about another 5,000 tons a year. So they're preventing a very large sediment load from reaching the Laguna. So from that, we can get to a sediment budget for existing conditions. You see on the left the sources. Upland erosion seems to account for about 20% of the input. Roads and the dry processes of soil creep and slides coupled with gully erosion, about another 25%. The biggest source in the system seems to be channel incision. That channel incision is mostly occurring on alluvial fans. Lower Marquess Creek, I think, is one area where it's particularly documented. That's associated with hydromodification, change in the base level of some of these streams, and inadequate riparian vegetation. See on the right, the sinks, where does it go? Output to the Russian River is only about 5%. The SCWA sediment removal is about 23%, and the remainder is deposited in the Laguna. We can also use these techniques to look at what happened under pre-settlement conditions in this watershed. That, of course, requires a number of assumptions, which will be in our report, but just to mention quickly, we see in blue the current estimated loading rates, red the pre-settlement loading rates. On the source side, on the left, upland erosion was, of course, a lot lower before we started having, you know, activities that disturbed the watershed. There weren't any roads pre-settlement. The slides, creep, and gully erosion were mostly on the gully side, much less than they are now. And then incision of the channels was also much less. Our estimate here is based on about basically a steady state dynamic equilibrium balancing the rates of uplift in the system. On the other hand, we have on the right hand, we have the sinks. The total removal of deposition outside the laguna right now, that's relatively large pre-settlement. It was a large fraction, but the loads are estimated to be much less. Deposition in the laguna as a result was much less, and output to the Russian River was likely occurring at about the same percentage of inflow as it is now. I want to proceed on to the nutrient analyses, assuming we have time. And this is a little different because it's a work in progress that we will be reporting on in the near future. There's a strong linkage of this to the sediment analysis. The laguna is impaired primarily by phosphorus in terms of nutrients, according to the latest listings. And the load of phosphorus, the movement of phosphorus, is closely tied to the movement of sediment because inorganic phosphorus tends to be particle reactive, and organic phosphorus also tends to move with organic detritus and solids. So for the non-point sources of phosphorus, the upland fraction of sediment load is really the key to that phosphorus movement, because the surface soils and also the impervious surfaces that receive fertilizer or organic material or other phosphorus-containing materials that can readily be loaded to the laguna. I do want to mention, that, of course, that concentration also matters, concentration in the laguna, particularly during summer low flows. So we do have to account for more than just the external load. So there are a lot of lines of evidence for the biostimulatory problems in the laguna, having to do with both nutrient sediment and the Ludwigia overgrowth. Some of the things, the staff has done a lot of work on this over the years. There are models of DO impairment, how they're related to nutrient load. There are models of non-point source nutrient loading, including the land cover loading model. We developed a different sediment potency analysis that builds on the sediment budget analysis. And so I want to go through a little bit of that and then conclude with some nutrient numeric endpoints, NNE analysis, relative to what the likely overloading in the system is. So the most evident piece of the problem right now is the Ludwigia dominance. We know from the literature that high phosphorus concentrations strongly encourage this kind of problem, and we also know that shallow water growth promotes Ludwigia growth. There's been a fair amount of work on this done in Europe and France and Germany, where these have been problems since the early 19th century. There's also a feedback loop, because once the channels are choked with macrophytes like this, it further slows the flow, promotes more sediment deposition, also cuts off some of the dissolved oxygen exchange. We don't, however, have research to say this is the nutrient concentration that you have to achieve to address this problem. We looked at some of the models of dissolved oxygen impairment and nutrient loads. The staff did a lot of this. We did some additional sensitivity analyses. And they generally show that in the laguna, the dissolved oxygen is not surprisingly most sensitive to the oxygen demand that's being exerted from the sediment, which is basically the decay of organic matter at the sediment-water interface. Some of that depends on local growth. Some of that depends on ongoing inputs, and some of it depends on historical inputs of organic matter. And the DO is also sensitive to the re-aeration rate in these models, not surprisingly. And the re-aeration rate is likely pretty much restricted by these dense mats of Ludwigia, which tends to float on the surface, thereby cutting off some of that exchange. Staff also developed a land cover loading model. This has been a work in progress over several years. We took a look at that and went through some of the evidence they'd established, did some additional work comparing to rates that are shown in the literature, and importantly, we did an analysis of the loading rates from Sonoma County's MS4 monitoring of Santa Rosa Creek at Fulton Road. And these things all pretty much agree on the order of magnitude of loading rates. So we think the land cover loading model as currently constructed is a reasonable tool. This is based on monitoring of small drainage areas that tend to isolate individual land uses. But we also can expand that by looking at the results of the sediment budget and the analytical data on the phosphorus to sediment ratios in the sampling data from these land use studies and use that to use a sediment potency factor to estimate phosphorus load sources as well. But we're talking about non-point loads. I don't want to forget the other loads because they are important here, and they, of course, include the wastewater discharges, dry weather, urban and agricultural return flows, and very importantly, the recycling of historic legacy loads stored in the laguna. Particularly, this is another feedback loop. When we have low dissolved oxygen conditions, it encourages iron that's been bound up with ferrous hydroxides to be re-released from the sediment. But if we go and look at this upland load fraction, we can at this point do a pretty reasonable attribution of where this upland source phosphorus load, the non-point phosphorus load, is coming from. We see that the most important categories here, the contribution from the rangeland and forest is diminished because it has low loading rates. The contribution from grass and pasture and from the developed land, including the MS4s, is amplified relative to its land use area based on those sediment potency measurements. And I do want to note that these are preliminary results, so when we get through with this process, we'll have numbers that are probably slightly different here, and also compare them to the point source loads. We can also look at the pre-settlement conditions in terms of phosphorus loading using these tools. Under current conditions, the non-point upland load is somewhere in the neighborhood of 128,000 pounds per year, and I should note that it also includes some load that's not necessarily from the land surface, but maybe due to minor channel erosion events, because that kind of monitoring is implicitly included in the land use monitoring of these streams. But at any rate, 128,000 about under current conditions. Pre-European settlement, of course, there weren't any point source contributions then, but the upland load looks to have been probably on the order of 30,000 pounds per year, so on the order of a quarter of the current loading rates. So putting this back in towards a more regulatory consideration, we looked at the recommendations that are still under consideration by the State Board relative to nutrient numeric endpoints. Nothing final there, but there are draft recommendations. And we make some interesting comparisons there to the situation. Now, most of the laguna right now is not open water, but there is open water at Occidental Road, part of what used to be Lake Joneve. If we look at the chlorophyll A measurements there, the recommended maximum as an annual average from the NNE policy, or the draft NNE work, is 150 micrograms per liter. The observed median there is 401 micrograms per liter. Phosphorus concentrations in the laguna, we observe phosphorus concentrations in the range of 0.4 to 0.9 milligrams per liter. The recommended maximum in this draft to prevent hyper-eutrophication, about 0.1 milligrams per liter. See the distribution of the main stem laguna samples here. This is just the 2005 to 2012 samples. Box plots here, so the box covers the interquartile range from the 25th to the 75th percentile. The median's the middle line, and the whiskers show the maximum to minimum values. You see they are all quite a bit bigger than that recommended limit of 0.1 milligrams per liter. Of course, much of this may be due to recycling within the system, but it's true throughout the system from Stony Point, more upstream end, down to Grenville Road at the lower end. So on nutrient endpoints, our take is that right now preliminary work, so don't keep the numbers, but suggests that a reduction in phosphorus on the order of 65 to 85% is needed in the system to restore it to a situation that's not hyper-eutrophic. But it's also important to note that much of the current phosphorus concentration in the system is supported by recycling from hypoxic sediment, and that the whole interplay of sedimentation or external organic matter loading and Ludwigia growth makes this kind of a tightly wrapped ball of string that you can't solve by saying, We can cut off phosphorus load and everything will be fixed. We need to address these things, I think, as a group. But it's clear that some reduction in external phosphorus loading is going to be needed in this system. So I think at this point, I'm supposed to turn it back over to Dave, who can talk more about actual implementation.
Turn the lights back on. Sorry, everyone. Thank you, John, for the excellent summary and for joining us today. I'd like to close for the board's information with a brief review of where we go from here. As is evident from Dr. Butcher's presentation, the Laguna is a noisy and uncertain environment. Tetra Tech's recent assistance is of great value to us and to our stakeholders because it lends clarity to this complicated environment and it frees us up to do the next things we gotta do, develop targets, load allocations, identify implementation priorities, and recognize our data needs for adaptive management going forward. So I'll share with you now two last slides. One contains three things that we know we'll be doing on short order, and the next will be three things that we see some distance down the road. First, as John mentioned, in the coming weeks, we will be releasing the completed sediment budget documents. When we make those available, I will put them on our website, and I'll notify our stakeholders using the LIRIS list and also probably make several phone calls and send some emails. But the release of those documents is pending shortly. Secondly, as John also mentioned, we will be working with Tetra Tech to complete our nutrient analyses, trying to tie the nutrient budget to the sediment budget and resolve some of the work in progress items that we have yet to get to. Thirdly, I feel, especially with the release of the sediment budget documents, that we are finally at a point where we've been wanting to get to for some time, and that is to start evaluating opportunities with our stakeholders for the more deliberative portions of the TMDL development process. And that is, talking about future data collection and analysis and implementation priorities, and maybe, how we might manage allocations and targets in an environment where we have so many different impairments that are all so tangled together. I know that the town of Windsor and the city of Santa Rosa in particular have been very eager to plug into our development process, have offered to help and intend to be very engaged in our work going forward. And as staff, we've been saying, well, we don't quite have the clarity to help frame the discussion. And I think we are now at about that point where we can begin those talks. Now, for the stuff that's further down the road, the story with the Laguna and its impairments doesn't end with just sediment and nutrients. We need to thread in our dissolved oxygen, our temperature, and probably also our macrophyte problems into the, we need to bring those into focus and try to find a way, I'm hoping, to make tidy work of our regulatory requirements under the TMDL program. We do not want to roll out a stack of five different load allocations for five different pollutants, incorporate those into all of our permits in this watershed, and then attempt to track and monitor them as we proceed. We want to be more clever about how to solve that problem. Perhaps there is a surrogate parameter we can rely on. Perhaps there are some translators out there that we can use to identify the priority actions that we should be doing first, and to do so in such a way that our permit holders know what's expected of them and can easily grasp, what it is, the targets that we're all heading toward. We look forward to to proceeding with that work. I would love it if we managed to get Tetra Tech on board for another phase of work to help us with that, but regardless of their presence, that's what we'll be doing next. The last two things I'd like to mention, I think, are just plugs for other initiatives that we've been working on in the implementation realm of our work, and that is as our data needs come into view and as our implementation actions and perhaps our adaptive management strategy come into view, we will be in a place to develop some needs for more or new data, or maybe some needs for some special studies. And as we're able to articulate what those needs are, it is our intention at this time to plug into what we hope will be a regional monitoring program for the Russian River. We hope that will be waiting there for us when it's time to start talking about TMDL data development and monitoring requirements. And the development of the Russian River Regional Monitoring Program is currently underway. We've been talking with the Russian River Watershed Association first as a group of seed participants in a regionally coordinated monitoring effort, much like you might see in San Francisco Bay, much like we have up in the Klamath River Basin. We're hoping to follow a similar model, although scaled down to an appropriate size for the Russian. We're hoping to have that here locally. Lastly, the water quality credit trading market development effort that has been going on for about 3 years using conservation innovation grant funds from the USDA and led up by our local RCDs, that project is about to close, and we're about to receive a final set of recommendations for what a water quality credit trading market framework ought to look like for the Laguna. And when that becomes available, we will have what we are hoping is a piece of the plan for moving forward in the Laguna with implementation. We do still think that there is a place for water quality trading that looks maybe a lot like the nutrient offset program that we currently have active in the basin. We're hoping that that remains an open compliance option for us, and we're eagerly awaiting that project to be complete. With that, I'm happy to open it up to questions from the board for either John on his material or from myself or other members of the Laguna team.
Thank you. Thank you both. a lot of information. John, I wanted to go back to a comment you made, and you passed over very quickly the relationship between Luwigia and water depth.
Yes.
And in my experience, both in Clear Lake and on the Sacramento River, depth plays a big role in allowing that plant to get established. I couldn't help but in trying to piece together the tremendous amount of information you shared with us, looking at historic configuration of the Laguna, looking at modern-day configuration of the Laguna. Are we dealing with a body of water that's trying to turn into a marsh because of sedimentation rate and because of alterations and how sediment rates may be changing? I mean, are we really, is that what we're looking at, that eventually this will simply be a marshland?
Well, okay, two parts of it. First, yes, depth is very important. Ludwigia will grow to healthy, grow up to about, 4 or 5 feet, and on wet, exposed land as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one thing you can look at in terms of control is deepening channels. Under historic conditions, there was a lot of open water. There was boating on Lake Geneva and Ballard Lake in times in the past. You are right that under current situations, it is trying to turn itself into a wetland instead of a lake. That is probably not the best use of it. The degree to which it will be addressed is, you know, an interesting question. I can't tell you. But right now we have an imbalance of too much sediment being loaded into it. It's not as bad now probably as it was at certain times during the past cycles of agriculture to development, a lot of active channel modification, but it's still in an imbalanced situation where it's, you know, just trying to fill itself in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Butcher. Your assistance is it's appreciated. It's good to see your perspective on this, and probably not too much of a surprise to folks in this room that I'll be asking a couple sediment budget questions.
Okay.
One of my full-time jobs. So you'd spent a detailed amount or provided some detailed information about 18 slides worth explaining the sediment sources, and then we've got one slide talking about the sinks.
Right.
Is that good? Can I infer that the data for the sinks is good and not really within question? You had listed some USGS,
right,
some reservoir data that you had looked at because of a discrepancy between the PWA work and what the USGS had said. How do we feel about the sinks?
Okay, well, that's a good question, and I could have put more slides in about that.
I'm sure you could have.
Ran over
at risk of.
But, okay, so USGS did a couple of things to measure sedimentation rates within the laguna. They had clay tiles they put out to measure deposition. They had looked at changes in profiles, and they did a lot of dendrochronologic work to look at buried tree stumps, basically. And then they developed a model of deposition potential kind of tuned to those three things, and from that, the Curtis et al. Paper says that their best estimate of the deposition rate in the laguna was 61,000 tons per year. If they give it in cubic yards, we converted everything to mass for this comparison. So that's a number. It's an imprecise number. It certainly varies a lot from year to year. Their monitoring included the New Year's Day flood in, what's that, 2006?
2006, I believe.
Yeah. And so they had a big event in there. But between the 3 years, it looks, still kind of typical. But those numbers are certainly uncertain. The other sinks are the output to the Russian River. If you look at the suspended sediment concentration monitoring at Mirabel, it is almost immune to changes in response to flow.
No hysteresis?
Not much. It's, just random noise, basically. And does not suggest that you have a very effective trap in the laguna itself. Sometimes, the high flows that occur there are often accompanied by backwater in the Russian River, so it's hard to, push stuff
sure,
out.
Sure, no, I realize the errors or the bounds that we have to put on some of these estimates.
And then the third one, which, surprised us being so important, was the channel maintenance activities. And they, of course, vary a lot from year to year because they're based on need and they move around from place to place. We wish we had more years of quantitative measures than the seven we do, but that varies from year to year as well. But I think we have a reasonably good picture of a lot. So there's uncertainty on every side, but we have enough pieces, I think, to understand the relative magnitude of what's going on. Certainly, one piece can shrink and another one could get bigger, but I think it's enough understanding to move forward. And it's also, in my experience, is more information than we often have in sediment TMDLs.
Have you got to the elk yet?
That's tomorrow.
Okay, so assuming do we assume as a conceptual model that we had under pre-settlement conditions a balanced sediment budget, or do we feel that the laguna is acting more of a sink? And then I guess to build on that, what are we going to set as a baseline condition by which to build the TMDL?
Okay, so
maybe part A would be to you and part B to David.
Yes, that's right. That's what I was going to say. We expect that, it was approximately in a dynamic equilibrium, balancing the tectonic uplift, which we don't have exact measurements of either, but is, a few tenths of a millimeter for here or something like that. There are some other confounding factors near the Indian populations did do a lot of burning that may have caused other things to happen, but it's clear from the soils data and the Spanish colonial era maps that there was a lot more open water, so that the balance has definitely changed, even if it wasn't fully in equilibrium before.
Great. Thanks.
And now on to part two of your question. You asked about what should we or what will we use as a baseline for our sediment budget going forward.
And a to-be-determined answer is just fine? I don't just know if you've got it yet.
It is most certainly to be determined. I can say with confidence that there is not a pre-settlement target mm-hmm. in our future because of how drastically this system has been altered. There's no undoing the amount of doing that has gone on in this water body. And that's something we acknowledge, and it's something that, you know, we feel that the regulations allow us to grapple with. I can say that the way we've been looking at how to deal with many of the problems in the Laguna is to bring function back to the Laguna. We know we're done when the beneficial uses are being supported, right. But I like to think of in terms of what functions did we used to have that we've lost, what targets can we set that would, you know, restore those functions. So for instance, the water agency's surprisingly large contribution to the sediment sinks category. Under pre-settlement conditions, the sediment that was coming out of the hills, the erosive hills in the Laguna Basin, largely just settled on the alluvial fan, mm-hmm. never made it down into the bathtub. Now that we've channelized all of our streams, well, now it would make it directly into the bathtub. The Sonoma County Water Agency's sediment removal activities, their stream maintenance program, we think has essentially replaced the function that we lost. Mm-hmm. Or if we dialed it just right, the water agency stream maintenance activities could equal the alluvial fan development rates that we would have expected to see. And that was something that I know was news to the water agency folks, and music to their ears to realize how significant a contributor they are in this watershed to keeping it from being even more buried. And I know Mike Thompson and Pam Jean had to leave the room here before we finished, but I'm pretty sure I was expecting a plug for the stream maintenance program. When we talk about baselines, I think what we're going to try to do is equate rates associated with functions that have been lost to what is it that we can do to restore those functions.
Fantastic, thanks. How are you doing back there, Clayton? You've just been... he was up, he was down, he was up, he was down. Thanks, Dave. That was fantastic.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Good. I just want to say, I think the test of rates of sediment to functions lost is the right way to do it, because we're not, in a bizarre way, we're not after sediment. We're really after the effects of sediment on beneficial uses. And you can have a net outflow of sediment every year, but if it's not sufficient to restore functions, then it's not good enough. So I think you've bored down on exactly the right way to look at it.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Hey, I actually grew up in this watershed above Matanzas Creek.
The one that did the legacy okay. stuff.
I actually do the MS4 testing too. I'm a consultant by day, so I sell myself in the day to go do that type of test in the middle of the night. But you know, it's funny, we moved to Bennett Valley, my family, in 1971, and all the kids in the neighborhood kept telling me and my brothers about, hey, there's a big lake down there below Grange Road. And so finally me and my brother got brave, and we just waded down the creek one day with Mark Pavlovich until we came to this huge lake. And for years we'd go down to Matanzas Reservoir, and we would swim and fish and mess around, and it was big. It was big enough to where you could almost water ski on that thing probably if you really got into some tight turns. In the 80s, I recall, was the first time they dredged that. And as I recall, I want to say there was like something like 200,000 tons of dirt taken out of that thing.
Yeah, there was a lot.
And then I think they did it a second time. A fellow that I work with did a master's project, and he went up there and looked at it a while back, and it's a thin trickle now because they don't dredge it anymore. At the same time, in looking at, you know, the watershed as a contribution of sediment here, and by the way, I very much appreciate your analysis, both on the sediment and the nutrient. You know, Bennett Valley and that area up in there is Petaluma Formation and Sonoma Volcanics, primarily fine-grained material, at least from the Petaluma. And it comes down fairly low into the watershed, into mm-hmm. the Laguna, right? That we have a lot of essentially urban streams that come off the west side of the Mount Taylor and Sonoma Mountain that contribute to the lower end of the Laguna especially. Mm-hmm. Do you see any differentiation between either source, whether it be just straight-up geology, you know, Sonoma Volcanics versus Petaluma? You know, we have a certain amount of alluvial and colluvial material that's entrained in the lagunas, or at least in the floodplain itself, as a contributing factor to the nutrient impairment part of this thing.
Oh, to the nutrient impairment, yeah. We certainly see it on the sediment side. On the nutrient side, I think yes, because the sediment erosion rates are definitely higher there, but I can't tell you right off whether the phosphorus to sediment ratios differ spatially there.
Fair enough. At the same time, do you distinguish at all? Is there any distinguishing between orthophosphate and total phosphate?
Yeah. The rates I showed you are based on total phosphorus. Orthophosphate is, if you look at the fraction, it's fairly similar in terms of the high flow loads. The big difference is it is in base flow conditions where you get a much larger orthophosphate fraction and you see the effects of the urban background loading and agricultural return flows and so on.
Yeah, I just, to note, I've seen orthophosphate numbers be, on the order of 2 to 3 times higher than the total is what we typically see.
Too, but
One other thing is in this right here, though, in this pie chart of contribution of this is a phosphate total contribution, is there a sediment load here that's not really accounted for? I mean, in looking at the sediment load, the anoxic sediment loading, which you alluded to, this is a pretty well-filled channels, at least in portions of it. And the sediment load that's got to be the nutrient sediment load and the DO oxygen demand from that's got to be fairly high at times, I would imagine.
Okay, so there's a couple of pieces there. One, you're right that the nature of the monitoring is a small, mostly single-use watersheds, but it does include more than just upland load. And so the sediment, we're making that figure with the sediment that's upland derived. So it's not accounting for phosphorus, for instance, that is contained in eroding stream banks, toes of small slides, that kind of stuff. We expect that to generally be on the lower side. We don't have it quantified at this point. The other part of it is clear from the dissolved oxygen modeling that external input of organic matter, so solids but not sediment, is an important part of the overall DO balance, although it's pretty hard to tease that out from what's already in there, some of which may have to do with some past disposal practices and things like that.
But is it fair, though, to say, John, that in the order of things here, because what we're going to get to at the end of the day is load, waste load allocations and load allocations here, and that looking then at, ag versus municipal versus forest versus vineyards, all this kind of stuff that will get quantified into that calculation. How then is the sediment load calculated into that? If we have an entrained sediment load in what's in essence a many mile long water body here that is not attaining water quality, but some of that is entrained within the sediment that has been deposited over long periods of time.
Well, that's also true. You would need to make assumptions about steady state condition over time in terms of concentration on bed sediment to figure that out, or you can make non-equilibrium assumptions, but most likely an equilibrium assumption there. You would have to make assumptions also on the background concentration of subsurface soil phosphorus concentrations in the watershed, which we have some limited information on. So we can add some pieces to this budget, also add in some of the point source and dry weather sources to the extent that is helpful. We can try to do that. I think from what Dave said, it's also going to be a process where it's more important to know what's important than what the exact numbers are on it. But I think we can improve it. You can always improve these things infinitely with enough.
Well, I appreciate it. I actually look forward to reading your document, both of them, when they're there. The very last thing, Dave, is, within that regional monitoring plan, and we'll see it here pretty quick with the MS4 renewal that's coming, is to also tailor then and to calibrate and optimize the MS4 sampling, which I imagine could be wrapped into the regional monitoring program that will also further inform the TMDL outcomes here. We had a rather wide swath of analytical components that were included within the MS4 to begin with, and that slowly whittled down to more kind of targeted things. And I'm sure there's room to get closer to that, to what's optimal here, to what we're looking for impairment recovery type things when we're MS4 sampling's being done, especially on these two locations, which you alluded to, John, C1, C2. There's an upstream, downstream that there's quite a lot of data on.
Mm-hmm.
You alluded to 2005. And then there is a third sampling point, C3, which is actually up above Matanzas Creek, that there's a limited amount of data on, because I know because I collected it. So it's out there.
The monitoring activities under the MS4 are very much on our radar. We've been working with Colleen Hunt, who you will hear from soon on that renewal. And the way we've been looking at the requirements under that permit is there are probably at least two flavors there. There are the data that our permit development staff need to generate an NPDES permit. That's either detect pollutants that are there that for which requirements might be necessary, or it's just verifying that additional requirements aren't necessary because a particular pollutant isn't there. There's also some performance or compliance measures that Colleen gets out of that batch of data. The other data, things that could be used to inform TMDL development or to be read as, you know, performance of implementation actions taking place. Those would be the monitoring needs and maybe the special study needs that I mentioned during my last couple slides. And that's part of the reason why we're so excited about this work, is that it makes it a lot more clear to us where our needs may be. And we have no intention to not utilize our existing permits and the monitoring and reporting programs within them to help us with our TMDL work. There does not need to be a separate monitoring and reporting program attached to our TMDLs that can't be fed into each of our existing permits. So that is very much within our sights, and we're hoping that the regional monitoring program is the perfect stage for all of that coordination.
Great vehicle
to happen.
Yeah, it's a great vehicle to get at some of that stuff. One very, very last thing. I would really like to hear about the nutrient trading program as it's been developed. I've heard about it a little bit around the edges. I've heard some big complaints about it, frankly, mm-hmm. at the same time. If it's going to be a component of TMDL implementation and options, which I believe it probably could be, I would really like to hear about that sooner than later and not just give me a pizza that's already all made. All right.
No problem. We
And Shinrei, I know Matt left the room, Shinrei, so I can make that request at the end, but I'd like to hear that about that pretty soon. Okay.
At the risk of over-volunteering, I can tell you that we have a plan for that. When that project finishes, what we will be furnished with is the advisory committee's best ideas for what a framework should look like for a water quality trading market. It's essentially a stack of recommendations that represents the advisory committee's best thinking for 3 years. Once those recommendations are available to us, then we have a few options. One, we could come and say, hey, so here's what we got from those guys. What do you think? Two, we could offer to retrofit or propose revisions to the nutrient offset program to improve it for efficiency, to open it up as a compliance option for the town of Windsor. As you know, they'll need a compliance option before too long. That's been an idea that I have suggested in many different groups and which has been to date warmly received. So my current plan is within the next year to be in front of the board with at least a report out on that water quality trading, you know, development effort. But perhaps even so far as, hey, let's take the recommendations that we've received and put them to the test by upgrading our nutrient offset program. So it'll be one of those two, and I expect it'll be within the next year that you'll hear about it.
Well, and isn't it fair to say, too, Dave, that, I mean, you've come before us, maybe it was in November, where you were talking about creating a currency out here of projects, right? And, mm-hmm. in fact, Mike Thompson talked about that, too, and some of that stuff, and I think that's right. It's not all about nutrients, though, right? You talked about removing some log jams or some debris dams, I believe, in the lower Laguna system and some of those types of options that aren't necessarily nutrient trading programs, but they certainly are a project. I don't want to call them a project trading program, but there are potential projects in the extent of the Laguna that could be a palette of options out here and of possibilities. And they get rather big rather fast, I know, but it'd be really nice to know about some of that in detail as we go forward.
You bet. I will be glad to come back to you to talk about that, because that essentially gets to the heart of the matter and I think is the nexus between several of our different initiatives. You know, we've been doing nutrient offsets with the city of Santa Rosa. We've been developing this water quality credit trading market. We've also been grappling with what should our targets be? What parameters should we be tracking? And it could be that the surrogate parameter, the key TMDL target that comes out of our TMDL development work, is the future currency for a trading market. I'm hoping that's it works out that cleanly. But I think that's where the two roads meet, is we need a currency to encourage activities that we know will help the watershed. We also need something to tune in terms of, you know, are we making progress or not in recovering this impaired water body? And hopefully those two things are one and the same, or at least, you know, can see each other.
Great. Thank you. Thank you too, John.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Because many of us are likely to get asked this question, and I know that Brenda sitting behind you will absolutely get asked this question, where are we now as a result of Dr. Butcher's work in particular? I mean, I understand teasing out why a particular model didn't work or why sampling method didn't work. Where are we now that we were not a year ago, and where will we be a year from now?
That's a great question. That one's on my mind a lot. Where we are now with the assistance of Tetra Tech is we have more quickly arrived at some synthesis and some, how should I put it? I feel as if, especially for the sediment side of things, we have established the floor and the ceiling for what these sources and sinks are in this watershed. And prior to now, we hadn't quite made it to that point in our analysis. And we lucked out in getting Tetra Tech's assistance, and I'm glad for it, because without it, I think that our progress on the technical TMDL development side of the program would have been slower than what we promised when last we updated you. I think that with Tetra Tech's assistance, we've been able to keep moving on the progress that we were hoping to make technically in this watershed, all the while being able to continue to cultivate and maintain our participation in a lot of our early implementation activities. So on the sediment side of things, I feel that we've got a nice bracket here and definitely actionable information to move forward with the later parts of the TMDL process. Nutrients, I hope we will be close to the same thing at the end of Tetra Tech's current phase of work. In a year, according to our current TMDL project schedule, we should find ourselves having released a peer review draft of the technical chapters of our TMDL. And we'll probably be sitting on the comments from our reviewers, or maybe even preparing the responses to our reviewers. That's what our current project schedule says. I understand there's been a lot of movement in the EPA, both in terms of the support staff and the personnel that we work with, but also in their approach to TMDLs, especially the complicated ones. They're talking about new, you know, watershed approaches and alternative restoration plans. And so I'm still trying to wrap my head around, you know, whether the traditional understanding of where we're heading with this TMDL project is going to hold with the new advice and guidance we're getting from the EPA. But that's where we stand currently.
Thank you.
Any other board comments or questions? Okay, we'll open it up for the public.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Rita Miller, City of Santa Rosa, and Brenda Edelman.
Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to provide comments. First, I'd like to share the city's appreciation of the technical update that was provided today. Oh, my name is Rita Miller. I'm representing the City of Santa Rosa today.
And given there's only two, we'll give each party 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. As you know, the city is under a no-net loading permit requirement for phosphorus, and it's been very costly to comply with that. We're implementing our nutrient offset program, which we very much appreciate your staff working with us on that. As a result of the cost to our ratepayers, we're very interested in participating in the development of the TMDL, and I was delighted to see David's bullet on the slide indicating that he's ready to begin working with the stakeholders. We believe that we can offer some technical support, and we'd really like to be involved in the development so when the recommendations for the TMDL are brought forth that we can support it to our board and feel that it's appropriate to implement. So today I mainly wanted to reiterate our interest and offer to help with the development of the TMDL. The TMDL will continue to have impacts on our wastewater treatment compliance activities as well as our MS4 compliance activities. So also wanted to let you know that with regard to our nutrient offset program, we are continuing our technical work on developing crediting methodologies for in-stream restoration work, such as creek restoration, sediment removal, and potentially the debris removal that the Water Agency had shared about last November. So we are doing what we can to support the beneficial impact to the ecosystem with the compliance dollars that we're spending on our permit compliance. So I think that's all I wanted to share is, you know, we are very interested in supporting this continued work because it will definitely have an impact on the city's compliance activities and, you know, result in pretty significant cost to our ratepayers. So thank you very much.
Mr. Questions. Chair,
Rita, did the city fund the Colgan Creek Channel project? Was it Colgan Creek, the one that's down there by Maria Carrillo?
Yes, that project was led by our Stormwater and Creeks team, and we did get grant funding, but we also did utilize some of our Stormwater Enterprise funds for that as match money.
Did you at all, was that part of any nutrient offset program or any credits towards any of that in-stream restoration?
We hope that it will be. We have been talking with Regional Water Board staff about that possibility. The difficulty is we have not had the crediting protocols that we need in order to determine the amount of credits. So before the project, we did do the sampling to determine nutrient levels in the sediment in the soils removed. And with the work that's ongoing, we hope to use that project as a pilot in-stream crediting project and hopefully derive some nutrient credits as a result of that.
Do you recall how many feet of channel were restored?
I think in total, all three phases of Colgan will be a little bit more than a mile, and this particular phase, maybe 1,800, 2,000 lineal feet.
That was my recollection, too. It's a great project, by the way.
Great. I'm glad that you've been out there.
Yeah, we did a little bit of just a looking at that project. There was an RFP out for some of that stuff, and we did some sampling on it. Not me, but some people that I work with, just to get rid of some of that dirt, because they hauled a pretty good amount of dirt out of there.
Right, yeah, great. Glad that you've been out there.
Well, and you guys are a very important piece of this puzzle, so I appreciate you. You're always really straight ahead on this kind of thing, and your willingness to help, and I'm sure Mr. Kuzmar would welcome the opportunity to, he's got chocolate, I know. He offers it to me every time I come here. I think he's trying to sweeten me up, so watch out for that. But thank you very much for the city to being a participant in this.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, Rita.
Ben Adelman, and 5 minutes for her too.
Thank you. I don't think I'll need it this time, though.
See, the one time I give it, you don't need it.
But thank you anyway.
You want to roll it over to next time?
I wish I knew enough to speak for 5 minutes. This has been an issue that I've been concerned about for a long time. I really appreciated the presentation, and I'm learning a lot from it. My focus mostly has been on the phosphorus and nutrient issue, because for many, many years I was concerned about Santa Rosa's direct discharges into the Laguna. So I was looking into these issues, and one of the things our group was responsible for was initiating with some scientists, I'm having a senior moment with names right now, but in the year 2000, there was produced a study on the phosphorus levels in Santa Rosa's wastewater that went on to be used as part of the basis for declaring the Laguna impaired for phosphorus, and it was even used by Rebecca Fitzgerald in a report she did on that nutrient issue when she was working on it, I think about a year ago. So we're also seeing the Water Agency has been doing some analysis of many different other nutrients as well as other toxins, but the phosphorus stands out. When you look at it, they did about 26 samples on the 5 major lower beaches in the Russian River, and every single one of the phosphorus readings was above that 0.01 level, and a lot of them were in the 0.2 to 0.5, I believe, level. And I've taken photographs of many years of the Ludwigia in the both the Laguna and the Russian River. And one of the big concerns I have is that there's going to be an EIR coming out very soon on permanent lowering of flows in the summertime in the Russian River. It won't affect the Laguna, but I think some of the problems in the river may be coming from the Laguna. So I have a lot of concerns about that. And I'm also I'm also very concerned, as you well know, about irrigation runoff from wastewater applications when the Laguna and the river are very low in flows. And I think that could be a significant contribution. I don't know that anyone knows at this point. But one of the things I discovered is that a lot of it occurs, I believe, as a result of the kind of spray infrastructure they use. And if irrigation was applied at either a very, very low flow or other means that doesn't spread a lot of water real fast, I think there would be a lot less irrigation, and I just want to put that in there when these permits come up. So I haven't looked at the MS4 data. That's something I'd like to do. But it is something I'm concerned about, and I'm concerned about some of the nutrient pollution in the Laguna, in the river, turning toxic because of the high water temperature and the low flow. You put all those factors together and you have a serious problem. And I really look forward to staying involved with this process because I think it's extremely important and will go a long way in addressing these issues. Even though your focus is on the Laguna and not on the river, I think whatever you do in the Laguna will help the lower river and also give you more information on which to base any kind of decisions that do involve the lower river. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, wait, Brenda, you don't get away that. No.
He's running you into the red line, I'm sure.
Because we do have low flow going on now, like we've never seen before. Right. And you probably, as well as anybody, see it on a daily basis. And Have you got, I mean, I understand it's not numeric, but do you have a anecdotal observations on what has happened, particularly from Hacienda down, because that's where you're going to have?
I can tell you a lot because I've been out photographing. I've been looking at the data, and just in the last few days, we're down to 68 CFS at Hacienda. In 2009, it went down as low as 47 in August. And that was when we saw the very worst algae and possibly toxic algae as well. The river doesn't look quite as bad in places near the dam where like before the dams went in at Vacation Beach in Guerneville, I had pictures of incredible amounts of, and I may have showed them to you, I'm not sure, of algae just upstream of Vacation Beach. And now you really can't see it. The flows are much higher, and in fact, I think the dam at Guerneville causes flows to back up further than Rio Nido, because we had documented a lot of algae at Rio Nido before the dam went in, and now that the dam's in, you can just see some of the Ludwigia, but you don't see all the other algae. I was in Mono Rio, and the river mouth's been open. The minute the river mouth closes, conditions change considerably at Mono Rio, but because it's been really open the whole time, I took pictures from the bridge just a week ago, and people were standing in the middle of the river, and the water went up to their ankles, and only the dogs could swim there. So it depends on where you are. You know, in the case of those very sad drownings, I read that there was 10 feet of the water just downstream of Hacienda, but at Hacienda itself, it looked very, very shallow in most places, but it varies quite a bit.
Thank
so
you.
I hope that helps.
Okay. Any further comment or observations? Okay, then we will have completed this item. That completes today. We're going to adjourn to executive session, but I'd like a 5-minute bathroom break, and then we'll go into executive session. And thank you, everybody.